Welcome to the 300 to 350 show, the programme that campaigns for a safe climate that's made for Resonance FM in London and syndicated free to independent media around the globe. This week we are very proud to present a recording we made of the Compassion in World Farming Peter Roberts Memorial Lecture given by Nobel Peace Prize winner and head of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, Dr. Rajendra Pachauri. Dr. Pachauri has made news recently by advocating eating less meat as a personal contribution to combating the problem of global warming and climate change. This advice has its basis in a recent report by the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization entitled Livestock's Long Shadow, which showed that beef and dairy farming are responsible for a massive 18% of global greenhouse gas emissions. That's more than the entire global transport sector. Climate Radio highlighted this issue in a programme back in June 2007, but Dr. Pachauri's advice gives the issue new prominence and new impetus. Here's the Chief Executive of Compassion in World Farming, Philip Limbury, introducing Dr. Pachauri to over 400 people from government, embassies, think tanks and research bodies at the Savoy Place on Monday the 8th of September 2008. The lecture is entitled Global Warming: The Impact of Meat Production and Consumption on Climate Change.
It is a huge honour to have Dr. Pachauri with us tonight, and please give a huge welcome. Dr. Pachauri.
Thank you very much. I'm really delighted to be here and feel greatly honored at having been invited to present this important lecture, the second of the series. And I also want to emphasize right at the beginning that whatever I say is in my personal capacity, because I did see a newspaper headline which said that the UN advocates eating less meat. I'm not talking on behalf of the IPCC when I speak over here. The IPCC, in its fourth assessment report, certainly did talk about and highlighted the importance of changes in lifestyle as an important means for reducing emissions of greenhouse gases. And what I'm doing is carrying that message further in my personal capacity by highlighting one change in lifestyles which I think can make a difference. What I'm going to do to start with is give you a few major findings from the fourth assessment report of the IPCC, and then I'll deal with the subject of consumption of meat and its role in contributing to emissions of greenhouse gases, and then talk about a few means by which we should bring about a reduction. This is just a view of changes that have taken place, and these are observed changes in global average temperature, global average sea level, and northern hemisphere snow cover. And you'd notice over here that this record of temperature changes, starting with the beginning of industrialization, has had obvious ups and downs, and that's essentially because changes have taken place both as a result of natural factors as well as human-induced factors. But what is particularly significant is that in recent decades, you see that the increase in temperature has been much steeper than in previous decades. And therefore, and I'll say a little more about this later, it's largely the result of human contributions to the concentration of greenhouse gases that you find this rapid increase in temperatures that's taken place in recent decades. And if one looks at the total increase, the average increase during the 20th century, it amounted to about 0.74 degrees Celsius. Corresponding to that, the middle diagram gives you global average sea level changes. And this, if I might mention, during the 20th century amounted to about 17 centimeters. Now, you could say 17 centimeters is not a lot, But if you're living in the Maldives Islands or, you know, on the low-lying country of Bangladesh, then 17 centimeters, which is pretty close to a foot, is really a lot. You don't even have to wait till inundation of that entire land area takes place as a result of sea level rise. But purely because of coastal flooding, because of storm surges, cyclones, there would be much greater devastation that would take place on account of a higher sea. Northern hemisphere snow cover has been going down, and you see this particularly in the case of the Arctic region, which is warming at about twice the rate of the rest of the globe. Now, in the fourth assessment report, we've come up with projections of temperature increases by the end of this century, and naturally, based on scenarios of economic growth, technology changes, and other factors, there's a whole range of outcomes that one can project. And corresponding to that, we get a range of these temperature increases by the end of the century, right from 1.1 degrees Celsius to 6.4 degrees Celsius. But we've come up with two so-called best estimates, one at the lower end, which we estimated at 1.8 degrees Celsius, and at the upper end, about 4 degrees Celsius. I might say that even the 1.8 degree Celsius increase does provide some cause for alarm, because that combined with the 0.74 degree increase that took place in the 20th century would add up to over 2.5 degrees Celsius. And in looking at the impacts of climate change, we have now come to the conclusion that a 2.5 degree increase in temperature will cause impacts that clearly would be quite unacceptable on any basis whatsoever, particularly on the basis of equity, because some of the worst affected regions in the world are those that are hardly responsible for having caused the problem. And these are regions where you have widespread poverty. There's absolutely no infrastructure or capacity by which they might be able to withstand the impacts of climate change. So the point I'm trying to make is that we really have to do something about the current trends, and we have to bring about some major changes by which we can take care of the future of this planet. This gives you a picture of the way emissions have grown since, say, the 1970s. And, of course, it's obvious that the largest source of increase has been from CO2 emissions based on the use of fossil fuels. There is, of course, also an increase in other sources of carbon dioxide, like deforestation, which is quite considerable, decay of organic matter and peat and so on. And then you have other gases like methane and N2O from agriculture and others. Now, if one wants to get into further detail on how much of these emissions are accounted for from production of meat, then we would really have to look at some numbers that I'd like to place before you. Unfortunately, the growth in global daily availability of calories per capita has not resolved food insecurity and malnutrition in poor countries, and in fact has increased pressure on the environment. Now, in recent months, as you're aware, there's been a substantial increase in food prices. And for some countries and societies where almost 80 to 90% of the household income goes for buying food, this really spells disaster. And as a result, we've had riots, we've had demonstrations, we've had protests in several parts of the world. But what is particularly sad is the fact that decades of effort to wipe out poverty have really been washed out by what has happened in recent months. So it's important for us to understand the inequitable and unequal nature of distribution of food, even though in the aggregate the world is now consuming a huge quantity of calories, both in per capita as well as aggregate terms. Its distribution leaves much to be desired. And during the last four decades, agricultural land gained almost 500 million hectares from forests and other land uses, people have been clearing forests. I was born in the mountains in India, and I remember the plains area just bordering the mountains used to be beautifully forested land. But as far back as the 1950s, all of that was cleared for agriculture. And there's even today a great deal of pressure, even though I think the government is much more sensitive to protecting forests. But a lot of damage has taken place in the last few decades. And this is not the example of India alone. It's happening in several other countries. Recently, I was in Brazil about 6 weeks ago, 2 months ago, and I was invited to speak at the Senate over there. And Madame Marina Silva, who used to be the Minister of the Environment, and of course she's now been replaced, and other senators told me that they're really concerned about the rate at which deforestation of the Amazon region took place last year. It seems to be increasing year after year. So, I mean, what we have to worry about is clearing of forest land for agriculture and related purposes. An additional 500 million hectares is projected to be converted into agriculture in the period up to 2020, mostly in Latin America and sub-Saharan Africa. If we look at accounting of emissions from agriculture, we have 80% of the emissions, total emissions from agriculture being accounted for by livestock production. And it amounts to 18% of all greenhouse gas emissions, which is shown over here. And I'm using data that's been provided by the FAO. I had erroneously thought earlier that it doesn't take into account the associated refrigeration that's required for the meat cycle, but I believe except for households where people have to store meat in their refrigerators and freezers, the associated carbon dioxide emissions from refrigeration at the wholesale and retail level as well as in transport has been accounted for in this 18% figure. Since people found out about this talk that I was going to give here today, I've received a number of emails from people that I respect saying that the 18% figure is an underestimate. It's a low estimate, and in actual fact, it's much higher. But I suppose this kind of dispute will continue. If we look at the proportion of greenhouse gas emissions from different parts of livestock production, well, a good part comes from deforestation and desertification, about 35.4%. Then the manure, both direct and indirect, because do remember that a large part of food grain production goes into feeding animals that are essentially used for meat. And there's enteric fermentation, which is also quite large, 25%, and other sources, all of which is shown over here in broad terms. Now, producing 1 kilogram of beef, I believe, leads to emissions of greenhouse gases with a warming potential equivalent to 36.4 kilograms of CO2. It releases fertilizing compounds equivalent to 340 grams of sulfur dioxide and 59 grams of phosphate. It consumes 169 megajoules of energy. And 1 kilogram of beef is responsible for the equivalent of the amount of CO2 emitted by the average European driver for every 250 kilometers. And it burns enough energy to light a 100-watt bulb for 20 days. Now, again, let's look at the inequity of the situation, and I'll say a little more about this later. There are 1.6 billion people in this world who don't have access to electricity and have never possessed a single light bulb in their homes. And that, to me, is a huge tragedy, placed as we are in the 21st century. So I'm not saying that a reduction in emissions over here will translate into lighting of the homes of people who don't have electricity today, but it just brings out the stark contrast between the situation in prosperous societies and those that are really deprived. Over two-thirds of the energy goes towards producing and transporting the animal's feed. Now, this is a significant figure, and this clearly points to the concept of factory farming of meat products. These are, of course, additional sources of greenhouse gases from meat consumption. Meat typically requires cooking at high temperatures for long periods. You can eat vegetables without cooking, and sometimes it's probably healthier to do that because you retain all the nutrition that's there in vegetable products. And a large proportion of meat also becomes waste products, bones, fat, past the date spoiled products, and so on, which are likely to end up on landfills and incinerated. So that's an additional source of emissions that we need to take into account. If we look at two types of equivalent meals, let us say, you compare a 6 ounce beef steak with the meal that's shown at the top, 1 cup of broccoli, which incidentally I hate, like the senior George Bush. The senior George Bush hated broccoli because I believe his mother used to force him to eat it. My mother never forced me to eat this broccoli, but I just don't like it anyway. 1 cup eggplant, 4 ounces of cauliflower, 8 ounces of rice. Now, if you look at what each of these two diets implies, one is associated with 0.4 pounds of CO2 equivalent emissions, and the 6 ounce beef steak amounts to 10 pounds of CO2 equivalent, which is almost 25 times as much. The livestock sector is by far the single largest anthropogenic user of land. Livestock production accounts for 70% of all agricultural land and 30% of the world's surface land area. And 70% of previous forested land in the Amazon is occupied by cattle pastures, and crops for animal feed cover a large part of the remainder. I was following Brazilian economy almost 15 to 20 years ago, and you would recall that there was a period in the 1980s when Brazil had a huge foreign debt, something like $120 billion at that point of time. And one of the means by which they decided to liquidate that and neutralize it was by converting large area of forest area, forest land, into pasture land. And that's when the whole problem started, but it has continued. And Brazil is not alone. There are several other countries in the world that have done the same. 20% of pasture land is degraded because of overgrazing, compaction, and erosion. So, you know, much of it then becomes unfit for any kind of cultivation. Other environmental impacts on livestock: amount of water needed to produce 1 kilogram of maize is 900 liters, rice 3,000 liters, chicken 3,900, pork 4,900, and beef a whopping 15,500 liters. So it's also intensive in the use of water if you take the entire cycle. Livestock is responsible for 64% of ammonia emissions, which contribute to acid rain. Livestock is among the largest sectoral source of land and water pollution, with nitrates and phosphorus, from slurry and silage which runs off, and from the use of nitrogen fertilizers. So if one takes the sum total of all these impacts, then clearly we have not really accounted for all the environmental impacts of meat and its consumption, production and consumption. Impacts of livestock on food availability: well, 1/3 of the world's cereal harvest and over 90% of soya is used for animal feed, despite inherent inefficiencies. It takes close to 10 kilograms of animal food feed to produce 1 kilogram of beef, and 4 to 5.5 kilograms of grain to produce 1 kilogram of pork, and 2.1 to 3 kilograms of grain to produce 1 kilogram of poultry meat. Now, all of this is really happening on a much larger scale than was the case, say, even 2 or 3 decades ago. And even in my country, in India, the poultry industry is really booming, and much of it is based on imported grains that are used for feeding the poultry stock. And I've been going to China for several years. My first visit there was 1981, when I think most of China used to consume pork and, of course, seafood. But today, China has had a major increase in consumption of meat. So typically what's happening is all around the world where incomes increase, people are shifting from vegetable to animal proteins and animal and meat consumption. Now, a farmer can feed up to 30 persons throughout the year on 1 hectare with vegetables, fruits, cereals, and vegetable fats. If the same area is used for the production of eggs, milk, or meat, the number of persons fed varies from 5 to 10. So there is a significant difference there. There are health effects of meat consumption, which I'm not qualified to talk about. I'm only talking on the basis of what one reads. Clearly, consumption of red meat does present health risks. And I got into vegetarianism some years ago because a former minister of environment, who was a good friend of mine, said, you're disgusting, you eat meat, because we traveled together on a few occasions. And, you know, I gorged myself with meat, and she was sitting next to me. She's a pure vegetarian. And she says, I defy you to go off meat for a month. I said, okay, I'll do it, and I'll show you what it's like. And to be quite honest, at the end of that month, I didn't feel like eating meat, and I felt much better because I was just existing on a vegetarian diet. So then I decided to become a vegetarian altogether, which does cause some problems. I recall when the Working Group 3 report of the IPCC was released in Bangkok last year, May of last year, there was a press conference, and we highlighted the fact that we had mentioned changes in lifestyles as an important part of mitigation measures. And somebody from among the media asked me, what kind of lifestyle changes? And, you know, being a little biased in this direction, I said, well, eat less meat. I think that would make a difference. And my colleagues in the IPCC from Latin America were not very happy about that. All right, so there are more qualified people to talk about health effects of meat consumption. But this is the way meat production has been increasing over a period of time. In 2006, farmers produced 276 million tons of meat, five times as much as in the 1950s. So that's a very sharp increase. And if we look at those countries where major increases have taken place, they are shown here, and of course these are not the only ones. There are others also. You see some significant changes and increases in consumption over here, which all add up to contribute to the increase that's taken place. And this data is taken from the FAO. If we look at expected trends in the livestock industry, well, estimated doubling of global production of meat up to 2050 could go from 229 million tons in 2001 to 465 million tons. And this is, of course, based on data compiled by Compassion and World Farming. So I'll run through these rather quickly because I'm sure there'll be a discussion on these. So I'll just skip these numbers. And this, again, is from the same organization, Compassion for World Farming. This, on the left-hand side, lists some of the things that are being done to increase meat output. And on the right-hand side are listed some of the implications in terms of what it does, both to the animals themselves, but also to what would happen to society at large. Now, what I'd like to say is there is a need for change in consumption patterns, and the reason why I'm talking about perhaps reducing meat consumption is because this is something which every individual can do. Often when one talks about climate change, in every audience there will be somebody who asks, okay, I accept all this, but what can I do in my personal life? You can tell them about changing light bulbs, going for compact fluorescent lamps, switching off lights when you move from one room to the other, walk wherever you can rather than jump into a car, keep the thermostat at a level which requires you to wear a cardigan rather than sit with a T-shirt at the peak of winter in your den in the home, and so on. But I believe that what we can do without too much effort is to reduce meat consumption. And I think that's a lifestyle change which each of us has within our powers to bring about. Reduction in the size of the livestock industry through reduced consumption is the most effective way of cutting greenhouse gas emissions. I was interviewed by somebody a little earlier in the day, and I was told that the UK beef industry, or whatever the association is called, is very angry about what I've said, and I would be surprised if they weren't. So, UK and US households waste around one-third of the food they buy. Change in consumption patterns will be required to achieve a low-carbon and sustainable society. Now, the power of British consumers, what would it amount to? Well, the average household would reduce CO2 emissions by more if they halve their meat consumption than if they halve their car usage. So, you know, this is an important fact. A family of four eating a quarter pound of beef burger each is responsible for the CO2 emissions equivalent of driving from London to Cambridge, 16 kilograms of CO2 emissions. So these are just some facts that bring out the importance and the implications of bringing about a reduction in meat consumption. How can change be achieved? Well, through the power of consumers and citizens, reducing meat consumption, choosing organic or free-range products, campaigning and raising awareness. BBC telephoned me a few days ago and they asked me whether government should legislate or require individuals to reduce their meat consumption. I said, no, I don't think that's right. Governments shouldn't assume that kind of role. They certainly can use fiscal measures where you internalize the externality that larger consumption of meat, or for that matter anything that's associated with carbon dioxide emissions, implies. Because we have said very clearly in the fourth assessment report that a major source of bringing about mitigation would be to place a price on carbon. And if there is carbon dioxide emissions taking place as a result of the entire meat cycle, then I think that cost to society should be internalized and there should be a tax or whatever. Now, this is something a good friend of mine, Jonathan Porritt, said, so I'm repeating that for you. But I want to highlight, let me turn from the individual to the general. I think the problem that we face with climate change is really a part of a much larger problem, and that's the problem of an unsustainable path of development that has been adopted almost as a monoculture across the world. And this is happening in the developed countries, it's happening in the developing countries. Now, I mentioned earlier that we have 1.6 billion people in the world who don't have access to electricity. Now, we could either set up thermal power plants and, you know, burn coal or whatever to provide this electricity. Even if we were to do that, a lot of them just can't afford getting an electricity connection to their homes. So my institute and I have launched a major program that we call Lighting a Billion Lives. And essentially, that's based on using photovoltaic technology. We've devised solar lanterns and solar torches, which incidentally have been customized to meet the needs of the rural poor in rural areas. And I think overall, what Gandhi said is relevant in every respect of actions that are required to combat climate change. Be the change you want to see in the world. Thank you.
That was Dr. Rajendra Pachauri, Chair of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and joint winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, giving the Compassion in World Farming Peter Roberts Memorial Lecture at the Savoy Place on Monday the 8th of September 2008. For more information, visit the Compassion in World Farming website at www.ciwf.org.uk. And if you'd like to hear the programme again, visit the Climate Radio website at www.climateradio.co.uk. You've been listening to the 300 to 350 show. Thanks for listening.